I cover the oil and gas industry. I have 3 kids, ages 4, 2, and 6 months. Ann and I have been married 8 years, and we live on Park and 78th. Though we're looking for a bigger place, because with a baby, it would be nice to have live-in help. Chapter 15. The playground's empty, Mary observed, hesitating at the gate. Gwen glanced at the swings and slides, the jungle gym beyond where a toddler entertained himself, by climbing rapidly away from a lackadaisical weekend nanny.
Can't get me, can't get me.
Well, good. You can swing as much as you want. However neutrally Mary might have intended it, Gwen felt the need to counter her daughter's statement. She pressed through into the playground. Come, Mary. Manhattan at 9 a.m. on a chilly April Sunday. Heading for her usual bench, Gwen felt it too. The disenfranchisement of a day and time that in other towns meant church or the running club or a bake sale. Whereas the city seemed freakishly deserted, a post-storm wreck of a place, trash on the streets, overflowing the cans, hardened mounds of snow so old and dirty they were unrecognizable as nature. She stood in front of the bench and beckoned to Mary. Come, honey. Gwen had spent the 2 weeks of spring break up in Massachusetts, returning with Mary a week ago. Easter, coming late this year, was still a week away. After any hiatus from it, the city was capable of asserting its peculiarity in her thoughts again. How odd, she'd thought, taking the elevator up with their suitcases. To live in little boxes, stacked above the ground. This is not how I pictured myself at all. Mary was considering her mother as if a strange woman had addressed her in a language she didn't speak. With a whoosh, now she flapped her arms and flew through the playground gate and off to the bigger kids' jungle gym. Taking a seat, Gwen watched her daughter with only a hint of the anxiety that sometimes beset her, that Mary's tractability meant something dire, that she would be forever overlooked, that she would always dwell, polite and not requiring all that much attention, on the sidelines of the city, which ran on vocal selfishness and greed.
"Can't catch me!" cried the toddler. "Can't catch me!"
"I'm coming to get you!" the Latina nanny called perfunctorily, not stirring from her bench or looking up from her phone. She was young and pretty, in jeans and boots and a sheepskin-trimmed leather jacket, her hair pulled back in a sleek ponytail. "Coming to get you, Miles!" When she did look up, she and Gwen briefly acknowledging each other, she had the expression of mild disbelief in her eyes that some of the more put-together caregivers got, which seemed to reflect the preposterousness of the job. No doubt the woman who employed her had some big career, resulting in a need for couples time, as people called it, on the weekends. Gwen looked at the young woman until she risked being rude. Another lifetime ago, she herself had interviewed nannies, half a dozen of them, from an agency a colleague of Dan's had recommended. It had never been one of Gwen's expectations to have a nanny. The term embarrassed her with its false aspirational connotations of uniformed Irish women and FDR's childhood. But she'd come to understand that that's what young mothers with her educational background and professional status did in this city, in this economy, in this decade. She never had gone for the PhD, but she'd been promoted up and out of the lab at Taurus into project management. The media flack about the conflicts of working moms failed to rile Gwen. When she got pregnant, she felt detached. Later, she wondered if the medicalized birth had augmented her sense of being at arm's length from motherhood. There'd been a relief in breastfeeding not having worked out. When Yangsum from Tibet started, Gwen felt awkward and stagey taking the baby from her when she returned from killing time on some invented errand. As recommended by the agency, the nanny was doing a 2-week trial period before Gwen went back to work, as if the facade of some primal connection might crack before the caregiver's enlightened gaze. The 2 weeks had been endless. Gwen counted the hours till she would be released from pretending to have somewhere to go, to have demands on her time. She was much too organized to appreciate having help when she wasn't actually at work. When she read some platitude along the lines of, "Nobody ever dies wishing they'd spent more time in the office," Gwen had let out a bark of laughter, thinking she'd be the first. She remembered it vividly. She was standing in the old Lexington Avenue Barnes & Noble. She'd wandered into the store to get out of a persistent rain and was turning over the self-help book stacked on the tables in the front of the store, checking her watch too frequently.
With an hour to go, and surprised to find herself missing the baby, Gwen headed, on an inspiration, back toward the children's section to buy the Velveteen Rabbit for Mary. There she saw a sight that unnerved her. Sitting on the spongy alphabet floor, sitting in the aisles with her backs up against bookshelves, sitting on the two steps of a makeshift stage propped up in the corner of the room in varying attitudes of boredom, relaxation, enthusiasm, and irritation, were a crowd of mostly Caribbean nannies. Playing beside them, climbing onto their laps, crawling over their extended legs, sleeping in newborn prams, were the small white babies and toddlers. A few were laughing, a few were whining. One, somewhere, was crying outright, the sort of desolate childish wail that makes one look twice, just to be sure. Gwen paused uncertainly. A little girl close by began to whine. She was protesting being strapped into her stroller, back-diving and crying. No! No, 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 no! As a heavy, beleaguered-looking nanny pushed her chest down and struggled with the straps. We got to go! We got to go, Eleanor! The woman straightened up and took a breath. Eleanor, I said we got to go. Mommy's waiting for us. Gwen wanted to offer to help, but she knew she must not. She stepped awkwardly around another nanny who was down on the floor on her hands and knees, chatting with a friend as, on a mat laid on the floor between two bookcases, the former changed a diaper, pulling a little girl's legs up and out of the way, and clapping on a Pampers with such a matter-of-fact motion that Gwen winced. She winced, and as she tried to push on toward the Velveteen Rabbit, she found she could not move. She stood there, squinting and listening to the crying, the wailing, the whoops of laughter, the chatter. A fetid smell of diapers and milk and wet cloth permeated the muggy room. No! 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 We got to go, Eleanor! We got to go! Sorry, Gwen said, flushing to no one in particular. And she forgot all about the Velveteen Rabbit, turned, and fled the store. It wasn't till weeks afterward, after she had told Young Sum apologetically that it wasn't going to work out, after she had given notice to her boss at Taurus, I find I want to stay home with my child, after she herself had headed to Barnes & Noble with Mary on a rainy Wednesday afternoon, that Gwen was able to ask herself what on earth had derailed her. The children weren't suffering, after all. Some of them had better nannies, some of them had worse. Gwen Hogan dealt in constants and variables, in empirical evidence collected over time. The chances were slim that this discrepancy would affect them unduly in their later years. Nor was Gwen such a bleeding-heart liberal that she couldn't view a group of young to late middle-aged women making between $350 and $750 a week without wanting to start a picket line. In fact, she was the inverse, a cold, disparaging liberal, voting the straight Democratic ticket year after year out of a clannish loyalty that felt more and more like a vice. Growing up, Gwen had never had anything material to be ashamed about. Camilla had made sure of that. But it was as if, in the moment that she paused in the bookstore, Camilla became obsolete. Gwen realized, quelling a convulsive sob, that her mother was no use to her now. Work hard. Do well. Gwen had done both. She had always done both. But shame had arrived in her life anyway, like some unwanted freebie that came in a package with her education, her career, her quick, surprised slide into urban life, when she saw a group of mostly black women working on their hands and knees as domestic servants, hired by people like herself. Not that Camilla had destroyed her entirely. Too lazy to take care of her own kid, she could hear her mother saying. In no way did that fit into Camilla Babineau's moral diorama. It's not that Camilla would have found the hiring of immigrant help unconscionable. It was simply nothing she would ever have had anything to do with. That night, Gwen told Dan that she thought she'd better stay home until Mary was in school. She called up and, trembling, quit the job she had trained years to do. She went on protesting to her boss, maybe if it wasn't for the commute, until she realized he hadn't argued. The conclusion was as predictable to him as it was cataclysmic to her. She felt mad, as if she were experiencing a lapse in the continuity of who she was. She kept waiting for someone to stop her. If not her boss, then, oddly enough, her mother. So proud, underneath the no more than I expected front of the Ivy League degree and the master's? Or Dan? She realized, sitting in the playground with the baby a few weeks later. The surprisingly delightful baby, Mary, her consolation in all of this, and soon her friend, in the very same park where she was sitting this morning, after having embarked on her new life as a stay-at-home mother, that if she hadn't necessarily believed he'd argue with her, Dan's mother, Connie, had stayed home and raised 5 boys after all, she had assumed he would at least be surprised, even shocked by the suggestion. "Are you serious?" she had expected him to ask, floored by the news. "You mean just give it up? Quit? After all these years?" In fact, Dan had absorbed the sea change instantaneously, as if he, too, had predicted it, his eyes sliding away from her as she prepared to defend the decision she thought he would want to grill her about. Instead, he began to talk quickly and vaguely about modern mores and the importance of making sure one made the right decision for one's own family, and didn't simply get swept up in what everyone else was doing. She was about to thank him for that when he pressed on. "Just because some women are totally career-obsessed. After all, we want a big family, right?" When, as a child, Gwen came home teary from some injustice another child had visited on her, Camilla had never failed to point out Gwen's probable role in the incident. And to be fair, because she had anticipated Dan's objections, Gwen had made her voice very sure when she told him. She wanted it to be clear that she had already made up her mind. There was a freestanding building on the south side of the park that housed the public bathrooms. When a door banged, both Gwen and the Latina nanny started. Someone was emerging from the women's side. Gwen put up the front page of the Times she'd brought so as not to stare at the resident homeless woman who, she assumed, would emerge, pushing a shopping cart. On the jungle gym, Mary got halfway across the monkey bars, hung there for a minute with a philosophical look, then dropped to the ground. But it wasn't the homeless woman. It wasn't the shopping cart after all. An incredible sense of luck stole over Gwen. She stared at the paper's headlines for a minute, as if the luck might evaporate were she to try to pin it down. At last she, who never won so much as a prize at a raffle, had been singled out for favor. Tentatively, she closed the newspaper, leaving her thumb in her page. It was Philippa Lye. Philippa Lye in her fur hat and that amazing coat with all 3 children in tow. The boy was complaining that he wanted a snack, and Philippa had the oddest reaction. Normally, when Gwen saw her with her children, she was short with them, peevish and even a little mean. But today she gave the boy a pat on the shoulder and said in an ethereally calm voice, "I'm sorry. I wish I had something, darling." Displeased, the boy began to cry. Gwen stood and gave an ineffectual little wave. "I have snacks." Philippa froze, like a deer on the lawn of a house, and just as lanky. But when she saw Gwen, she closed her eyes briefly as if in relief, as if some specific dread had been in her mind, not simply a reluctance to socialize in the park. "Hello, Gwen." She made her way over. Again, the voice was strangely calm, like the voice of a refugee, Gwen thought, who could not be shocked by any post-war trifle. "Hi, Phil." To Gwen's surprise, Philippa kissed both of her cheeks. Not expecting the second one, Gwen drew back, and Philippa's lips caught her forehead. "Oops," said Philippa. "De bisou. I never got rid of the habit. So affected, I know." "No, I'm just... Does he want something?" Gwen said impatiently, as if she were annoyed. "Is he hungry, Sebastian?" The 4 children, Mary and Philippa's 3, had watched this adult encounter as if held in abeyance. Referred to now, they sprang again to life. "I'm hungry, Mummy." Sebastian took the cue. "Don't complain, Sebastian," the older girl instructed promptly, shooting Gwen the quick, apologetic look of a child used to making up for parental lacunae. "Mom!" yelled Mary from the jungle gym. But when Gwen called, "Yes, what is it?" she didn't respond, as if she had merely been staking a claim. The little blonde one, silent in a misbuttoned toggle coat and rubber boots, edged closer, her eyes on the snacks. "I've got edamame, pretzel sticks, oatmeal cookies." Gwen flushed. She sounded like a barker at a carnival. She burrowed in her reusable Whole Foods grocery bag, suddenly aware of how unattractive it was, and drew out translucent snack cups with slow, stiff fingers. "She won't mind?" Philippa said, nodding her head toward Mary. "Huh? She won't mind sharing her snacks?" "Oh, no," Gwen understood belatedly. "She's not like that." Sebastian took handfuls of everything offered and shoved them in his mouth indiscriminately. "Do you want something?" Gwen asked the little girl, Ruth, and was appalled at how curt she sounded. "What would you like?" she tried more gently, but found her voice still came out sharply. Ruth said nothing, blinking her large eyes at the food. "Mommy!" The older girl's face was all twisted up. "Can we?"
"Go on, Laura."
It was the older one who got her mother's grief, Gwen saw, who, perhaps too often, made up for her failures.
"Go on, Ruth," Philippa said. "Take a cookie."
"Take two," Gwen insisted, in her Barker persona, pressing them on the older girl, who said in an overmature voice, "Thank you very much." She turned to her younger sister. "Here, Ruth, say thank you to Mrs. Hogan," Gwen filled in. "Mrs. Hogan, but you can call me Gwen." "Thank you, Mrs. Hogan." Mary had started going maniacally back and forth on the monkey bars, hoping it would make them notice her, no doubt.
"She's got so much energy,"
Philippa said, sitting down heavily on the bench and watching Gwen's daughter as her little girl and boy stood finishing their cookies, also watching Mary. The older girl lingered at the end of the adjacent bench, twisting herself uncertainly over the back.
"Yeah, that's Mary for you," Gwen said rather proudly, still holding the bag of snacks in case she should have to provide second helpings.
"Laura, come on!"
Philippa craned her neck around.
"Go take them to play. If you stay with us, they'll never go play."
"And how old are you?"
Gwen asked, she who never drew out a strange child.
7,
the girl said promptly, but without the performative instinct that animated most children's answer to the question. It seemed to embarrass her to draw attention to the fact. She looked away. A moment later, her eyes returned to assessing her mother.
"Mommy!"
"Laura, please!"
Philippa cried, with enough volume so that the nanny looked up from her phone and over at them. She went on, aggrieved, at the girl, who seemed to shrink in her shoes.
"Stop asking questions! Go and push Ruth on the swings, as I said. Stop loitering over here, for God's sake."
With no visible reaction, the girl did as she was told. She trotted to her sister and attempted to pick her up, then half-lugged, half-dragged the now giggling little girl toward the swings.
"Come on, Ruthie, come on, Ruthie, let's go swing."
When Laura began to push her younger sister, Mary ran over and took the swing next to Ruth.
"I'll swing. I'll swing, too."
The boy, Sebastian, noted the girls, but made no move to join them, eventually heading to the jungle gym, the latter of which he began to beat with a stick he picked up, ignoring the toddler boy who, puppy-like, tried to engage him, calling from above,
"Can't catch me! Can't catch me!"
Philippa eyed Gwen's bag.
"Could I have one?"
"Oh, of course. I'm sorry." Philippa took a cookie and ate it slowly. Gwen had never seen someone less interested in her children's play. Most mothers furtively watched theirs all the time, pleased by their activity. Philippa might have been alone in the park for all the attention she paid them.
"Do you come here most weekends?"
"Oh, well, I mean, we live near here," Gwen said. "Do you ever run into anyone from school?"
"Oh, no,"
Gwen laughed. "It's too far east." Absently, Philippa reached into Gwen's bag and took another cookie.
"I like it over here, though. I like Yorkville. I started out here."
"After college?" Gwen ventured.
"Oh, I didn't go to college. I didn't even finish high school. I took a Peter Pan bus to New York City. I wanted to be a model."
She gave a little laugh.
"It's funny that it all worked out. I mean, that was my idea, my ambition, and I just did it."
Not thinking, Gwen managed to be wry.
"I heard you were big in Japan."
But Philippa didn't seem to hear. She stared past the playground toward the river. Though you couldn't see the river, it was hidden by the trees. She broke the silence with a non sequitur.
"Do you get lots of useless presents at Christmas time, Gwen?"
Gwen thought the question strange.
Not really, no.
Don't you? She looked at Gwen. We do. Well, I mean, I don't. My husband does. People, they want to curry favor with him. They put him on their lists.
I'll bet, Gwen said. Big banker and all.
We get these awful fruit baskets and totally inedible chocolates. The back office, the middle office clients, oh, we get terrible wine. Bottles of obscure liqueurs. Gift certificates to useless stores. He used to leave everything at work. Give it to the staff or, I don't know, throw it out, I guess.
Sure, Gwen nodded. You don't want to have too much stuff.
Philippa frowned. Apparently this wasn't the point at all. One time I went into his office near Christmas, and I saw it all sitting there, and I said, God, here you're getting all this stuff, and I don't get a single thing. I mean, no one, but no one feels he has to curry favor with me, ever, or ever has. So I got him to promise to bring it home from then on. Gwen made a broad gesture as if to say, why not?
I like it,
Philippa said seriously. I can't explain it. I enjoy having fruit baskets and wine baskets and all those presents around. It makes me feel Christmassy, you know? Cup runneth over.
I could see that, Gwen said.
Though, in truth, she was suspicious of any gifts not exchanged among family.
Chocolate-covered cherries. I like knowing they're in the cupboard.
Yeah.
Peppermint hot chocolate mix.
Right. California wine, cheese, crackers, and grapes gift basket.
Okay.
What is it? April now?
April 5th,
Gwen said primly.
Depend on me to supply the obvious.
Well, a few days ago, I climbed up onto a stool. I mean, I had to climb up on a stool because they were put away in a high cupboard. And I got down that box of chocolate-covered cherries. Here we are in April, right? And these were from Christmas. Can you imagine anything more disgusting?
They don't sound that bad,
Gwen said diplomatically. I tore the package open, intending to eat one or two, and I ate double that, even though they were just horrible. They were worse than I'd imagined. I must have been craving sweets. I don't know what got into me.
Well, sometimes.
Anyway, I'm lying.
Oh, you are?
Gwen shifted her position slightly, glanced out at the swing set.
I didn't eat a few. I ate the whole box. I kept eating them and eating them. It was just bizarre, because if I had never kept them in the first place, I mean, they wouldn't have been available to me to gobble up. It never would have happened. It was so odd, so pointless, to keep something like that in a high cupboard for 3 months and then gobble them all up on some random Thursday.
Gwen felt warm in her fleece and down vest.
Well, she said. No harm done, I guess.
They watched the children. Mary was swinging higher and higher, pumping herself to great heights, showing off. She looked wildly happy. Embarrassed by the rush of love she felt for the child, Gwen picked up the section of newspaper she had been reading and refolded it.
It's how I feel about suicide, Philippa said.
What?
It's how I feel about suicide.
Suicide? Gwen said hollowly. She was lost. She'd thought the story was the weight obsession of an ex-model surfacing.
You see what I'm saying, don't you?
Philippa seemed to be prompting her for an even greater degree of attention. The newspaper crumpled in her lap. Gwen made sure not to let her gaze drop to it.
I mean, it's not something I'm about to go and do.
Gwen nodded uncertainly.
Okay. I just like knowing it's there.
As Philippa warmed to her point, her voice took on a coquettish, self-congratulatory tone. The story became more of an act.
I like having it in the cupboard, just in case.
Do you know what I mean, Gwen?
I don't know.
Like an obscure liqueur, or a gift certificate to a useless store. It gives me,
yes, that same feeling of plenty.
Gwen said stiffly.
But you have 3 children.
Right. Philippa sat back noisily on the bench.
That's the problem.
The problem?
It's nature's way of calling you out.
Gwen shook her head to show she wasn't getting it.
I'm sorry, Philippa. This is beyond me. She felt even warmer now, as if she were being held too close to a fire. She was beginning to regret the encounter. She had an urge to collect Mary and go home as soon as possible, get on with her day. Philippa went on imperturbably. If you're childless and you kill yourself, people judge you as they judge anyone who gives up the fight. But they pity you, too. They talk about the demons. The demons she must have lived with. But if you're a mother and you kill yourself... She paused, a rhetorical flourish Gwen could see. You're just a selfish shithead, aren't you? More or less. Instead of summoning her empathy, the performance was irritating Gwen. She forced herself to say, I'm sorry, Phil. I'm sorry it's so difficult. Oh, don't be, Philippa said in a rush. Don't be. It's probably better. I don't really want to be dead. I don't want my 80 million billion years of non-being to commence. It's only the gesture that's alluring. It is attractive, isn't it? You can't deny that. Not even you, Gwen. I can't? It's damn attractive. It's so definitive, the way that you can't argue with it. I love that about it. It's such a fuck you. And they'll know. The people whose fault it is, they'll know it's their fault. They'll make all sorts of rationalizations. She was always unhappy. But they'll know. But don't you have a nice life? Gwen said in a small voice. The bench was growing more uncomfortable by the minute, the slats digging into her thighs, her lumbar spine starting to protest. Oh, yes, very nice. But really, is living better than getting back at someone? Huh. Some days it's a toss-up. The conversation felt like a long setup for a zero-sum game Philippa was running, in which Gwen would be inculpated no matter what she said. It's about the party, isn't it? She said dully. Philippa looked thrown by the specificity of the question, as if it hadn't occurred to her that someone might drill down on the grand statements. The party? At the Steins, he... Gwen swallowed. John Curtis. She reddened as, with a sickening feeling, she recalled the moment she had attempted to introduce the two of them. But she said the name anyway, wearying of the melodrama and the vagueness. Minnie's husband, John Curtis. Watching her, Philippa said, Of course. You were there. You saw me... see him. Gwen nodded. He's an asshole, she sputtered suddenly. He's the biggest asshole. I knew him in college. Philippa looked puzzled, but Gwen ran with it. Confront him. Scream your head off. Go to the police. But don't do it. Don't eat the fucking cherries, Phil, she added grimly. Don't let him get away with it. Don't give him the satisfaction. I don't. People like that. He'll never feel remorse. I don't care if you kill yourself 10 times over. Gwen stopped. I'm sorry. God. Philippa hadn't moved. You don't have to talk about it. I'm really sorry. After a moment, Philippa said quietly, You know, I could have stayed home like Rose. I could be living in a condo where our old house stood, making ends meet, buying day-old bread and rotting fruit at the grocery store. Not you. No. But you see, Gwen, my point is, I fucked myself. I completely fucked myself. It was vanity that made me think I'd get away, do something. She intoned without obvious emotion. Everything that happened to me was my fault. But that's not true. Phil was shaking her head. You don't understand. I do, I'm telling you. I knew the guy. Do you hear me? Curtis, he's beyond. He's a... Philippa laid a gloveless hand on Gwen's arm. You really don't know, do you? She said incredulously. What? Are you always the last to know, Gwen? What the hell? Gwen said rudely, fed up with games. Oh, Gwen. Strangely, Philippa began to plead with her, giving her arm a little shake here and there for emphasis. It wasn't that bad. You have to understand that. I promise you, it really wasn't that bad. Philippa's trying to persuade her made Gwen afraid. Her eyes sought the children. She counted them to see that they were all there.
1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, sometimes I'd get this sort of poverty of thought. It was as if I had nothing in my head, no thoughts, just a blankness. I couldn't read. I stopped being able to read. Or else I'd become hyper-aware of everything. You know, my brain would describe things non-stop. You are rising from your bed. You are walking across the floor. I couldn't go to the grocery store. I couldn't go out and buy the paper or a magazine. I became a shut-in. I didn't go outside for a few weeks one time. I know that sounds bad, but it wasn't. It wasn't all that bad. I don't know. I could have gotten over it. People have gotten over worse. But then I had the bad encounter. She tilted her head back and her eyes searched the gray sky. And it kills me, she said to the sky, because I can't say anything. I can't complain. She turned back to Gwen, met her eyes. Because it was my fault. The girls had deserted the swings. They ran now as a pack to the jungle gym. Sebastian and the toddler boy stood and watched them as they darted up it, off it, circled the swings. Some serendipitous game of tag without any rules. I mean, he did rape me. It was my fault, but... It wasn't. Stop saying that. No, you stop it, Gwen, Philippa said viciously, seizing Gwen's arm. He was paying me for it, Gwen. He was paying me for sex. He had hired me for the night, all right? Can't you get that through your naive little head? Across the way, the Latina nanny was watching the two of them eagerly, as if her day had brightened beyond all expectations. Gwen knew she had to get the words out. She must get the words out. But they stuck in her mouth. In frustration, she shook off Philippa's hand. She heard herself pushing the sentence out, making the words audible one by one. I'm telling you, I knew him in college. He raped a girl in my dorm. A few girls, if you believe the rumors. He's a rapist. That's what I'm saying. I'm telling you, he's a known rapist. Gwen half threw up her hands, as if the very act of trying to convince Philippa disgusted her. She sat back as if to give up, folding her arms across her chest. But a minute later, she was right back in it. Did you hear me? This girl in my dorm. There were others. Everyone knew about it. But it was college. It was college, she repeated helplessly. Philippa had no discernible expression on her face. With a final, exhausted effort, Gwen said, Listen to me, Phil. You've got to listen to me. She enunciated very clearly. Just because he paid you. But at this, Philippa sprang to life. Oh, he didn't pay me, she said hotly. That's the thing. He didn't pay me, Gwen. She made fists of her hands and pounded her thighs with them. Fucking hell! In another minute, the children would notice, and Gwen would have to go head them off, make up some story to satisfy them. He never paid me. Never fucking paid me. You mean... Gwen shied away from formulating a specific question. He walked out without paying me. That's what I mean. He got it for free. Not only that, he passed me on to his roommates. He never paid you? Gwen repeated slowly, focusing on the fact. No. Philippa shook her head emphatically, like a child. He left the apartment. He left me there. I thought he was coming back. But I didn't get paid up front. It was, I don't know, an off night. One of those nights. She seemed to be talking to herself now, sorting her memories into logical order. At the beginning, he was trying to impress me. He kept talking about his job, bonds. He was talking about bonds. I just sat there tuning out. Then his two roommates came home, drunk. Real dickhead, one of them. And then a sort of follower on. Well, the dickhead recognized me. And I knew him, Adam Durbin. He'd been kicked out of my class at Dunning for drugs. He knew me, and you could see that made... Philippa hesitated. It made him mad. It was like we were ganging up on him. Durbin kept talking about school landmarks, people, you know, trying to piss Curtis off that he had a connection with me. Durbin didn't know that we weren't... Well, that I was working. The four of us, we all partied together. They had coke. The follower on made drinks. Her heart beating furiously, Gwen nodded, aware of the children, shrieking, running, shrieking.
I was just lying there, and he was fucking me.
He took me into the bedroom, and he said, I'm going to date you. I'm going to make you my girlfriend. Should I marry you? Oh, my God, maybe I'll fucking marry you. I can see the headline now. Yale bond salesman marries hooker. Well, I got sick of it. I wanted to get out of there, so I said, please, I wouldn't date you in 1,000 years. Some guys, they like that. You know, you dismiss them and it becomes a game.
Oh, no.
If only she had known, Gwen thought, about the polo shirts and the madras shorts, the seriousness with which he had pursued his new look. The toddler ran toward a pair of pigeons that were pecking at bits of trash near the park fence. At the last minute, they took off into the air, and the little boy squealed and clapped his hands.
You see, Gwen, I had to allow him to do it, or he would have really brutalized me. He was yelling at me, private school bitch, model bitch, and I had to sort of, Philippa's voice broke, pretend I was into it.
She broke down and sobbed.
Hell, I don't know, maybe I was into it.
Mom! That was Mary, jumping from a low platform of the gym down to the asphalt. The first to notice, unused to emotional vicissitudes from a mother.
Now's not the time, honey. I need to talk to my friend.
When Mary hesitated, Gwen raised her eyebrows and repeated firmly, Now's not the time. She found a packet of Kleenex in her bag and handed it to Philippa, whose face was a mess of tears and mascara. Looking directly at Gwen, she said,
I just tried not to complain or anything till it was over.
It was as if the gravitational pull on the bench had increased. Gwen felt so heavy on it that lifting her arm to pass over the tissues seemed almost more than she could do. Philippa dabbed at her eyes, first one, then the other. Gwen made to say something, but Philippa cut her off, clearing her throat with a loud, dismissive sound.
Everyone takes it up the ass at some time or another, right?
She said brightly.
I just happened to be one of the people who was destined to have it be literal.
She dragged a sleeve across her nose. Before Gwen could think of what to say, she asked,
Was that the case with the other girls? Do you happen to know, Gwen? Was...
She pressed her lips together before she could go on.
Anal rape his signature move, or was that just for me? I always wondered.
At her show of bravado, Gwen put a hand to her mouth.
Don't cry. Now's not the time. Now's not the time.
She bit down on the inside of her lower lip.
I don't know.
Well, Philippa said after a long minute, as if pointing out the silver lining, with the other two, they just had sex with me. Durbin couldn't even do it. He was too fucked up.
Mom? It was Mary again, with Laura now beside her, the two girls scrutinizing them from the jungle gym. Gwen called to them.
Better enjoy yourselves, honey. We don't have too much time left.
The two girls sank to seated positions on the jungle gym platform, as if they'd agreed that the time for running was over.
Can't catch me! Can't catch me!
Maybe I don't want to catch you, shouted Philippa's boy.
So, anyway, I never got the money.
She attempted a matter-of-fact tone, but her face contorted.
I didn't get the money, Gwen. I never got the money. If only I'd gotten the money. I was so poor in those days, Philippa said. You have no idea.
Gwen didn't contradict this. She sensed that this, oddly, was the thing that got to her, that she couldn't stop from getting to her each time she thought about it. It always got to her, and it drove her to the contemplation of the chocolate-covered cherries.
I was so poor, and he did that to me, and he never paid me.
It was her opportunity, Gwen realized later, to be the voice of consolation and of reason, to tell Philippa that it wasn't, of course, about the money.
I can see what you mean, but that what she needed was long-term psychological help to understand the real, terrible wrong that had been done her, for which not getting the money was only the substitute grievance.
Or perhaps, more practically, it was the moment for Gwen to suggest prosecution. She was certain, looking back, that anyone else in her position would have handled the situation much more competently than she. None of those responses came into Gwen's head just then, however. But the girl who remembered a dollar an older girl had promised her in fifth grade, if she switched seats on the bus so the older girl could sit next to her friend, the babysitting family who gypped her because Mrs. Franklin didn't have change for a 20, the cab she'd taken back to the city from New Jersey on the evening of a blizzard in the mid-90s with three other tourist employees, but whose entire bill she'd gotten stuck with. That girl sat stiffly on the park bench.
"Well, that's not fair," she said.
"No,"
Philippa said, wiping under her eyes with her knuckles. The two women eyed each other.
"It's not. Is it?"
Chapter 16. Their neighborhood Italian was one of those family-owned places that still appealed to a certain type of Carnegie Hill customer. Checkered tablecloths, signed photos on the wall. Other patrons, Gwen thought, must have returned with expectations of warmth and recognition, the rosy red wine glow you could never quite achieve at one of the trendier places. The Hogans dined there a couple of times a month. Date night, the St. Tim's mothers called it. But the phrase encapsulated everything Gwen had hoped to avoid in marriage. Tonight, Gwen arrived first. The pouty, silver-haired maitre d' welcomed her with false enthusiasm.
"Signora, buonasera,"
and with a pained flourish showed her to a table. Dan, he preferred. Dan ran up the bar tab. Dan had a quick, contemptuous authority that people like Silvio recognized.
"Buon appetito,"
Silvio gushed when he seated Dan a quarter of an hour later, turning a kinder eye on Gwen now that he could pair her with husband Dan. She smiled up at him, something touching and ridiculous about the man's prejudices. Dan whipped his coat off and hung it on the back of his chair.
"Sorry I'm late."
Mary had gotten her Easter basket last Sunday. Dan's Lenten regimen had ended. He had his hand up for a drink before he had fully taken a seat.
"It's okay."
It really didn't bother her. She liked sitting in the restaurant, soaking up the setting with no demands on her time. And she still felt, 15 years in, a sense of anticipation waiting for Dan Hogan, a pride of ownership that the years hadn't taken away.
"Silvio's funny," she said. "I'm pretty sure he recognizes me, but he pretends to be only pretending to recognize me."
"Ha!" Despite the laugh, Dan looked as if he wasn't concentrating on her. She'd wait till he had his drink to ask him her question. The place wasn't crowded yet, and their waiter appeared promptly. Dan ordered a vodka martini.
"Let's get the wine now, too.
Let it breathe."
This was a joke, though one that only Gwen recognized. With an obsequious, "But of course, as you wish, sir," the man went off to fetch their $32 bottle of Calabrian Red. Waiting for the drink, Dan drummed his fingers on the table, craning his neck around to the bar every couple minutes to gauge its progress. At last, it arrived, and he took a long sip from the glass, looked happier at once. Another big gulp, and he actually seemed to relax.
"We should come here every week. It's good to get out."
"Yeah,"
she swallowed.
"Dan?"
She knew he wanted only to escape tonight, and she felt a little ill going ahead with it. But she never got a chance to talk with him. He'd been working late. She went to bed early.
"What's up?"
"I've got to ask you something." It made her self-conscious to ask him for a favor. It wasn't part of their lingo. "It's about Philippa."
"Yeah?"
Dan looked wary.
"Okay."
Gwen pursed her lips. "God, I hate to bring this up, but..."
"You're doing an intervention."
"Huh?"
"Just kidding. She could use one, though, boy."
Childish antics failed to rile Gwen. She went on. "You know, after the Steins, when we were talking and we were assuming..." "Well, it turns out it's all true." She glanced at him. "About Curtis, I mean."
"What's true?"
"He did rape her."
"Wow," Dan said. And she knew at once that it was not a reaction to the fact, but to her having brought it up.
"Just as we thought."
"Okay, glad we're finally getting a chance to have a nice dinner out together."
"And I was thinking," she persisted. "Well, I was thinking..."
Her sheepishness increased as she ventured into his world.
"I was thinking she could prosecute him."
She felt silly using legalese.
"I was thinking maybe..."
There's a chance it's not too late.
Is it too late? She asked softly.
Dan looked flabbergasted.
She could?
He said, sounding incredulous.
She could, huh? I already am, Gwen. You realize that?
No, I know. I figured you were... Gwen admitted. When you said... But I just thought, if she were to pursue a conviction of her own, it might help her to move on. Not that I'm sure you ever really move on, but...
Oh, my God.
He ran his hands through his hair.
You know, I went after him before, right? I mean, what about me? I haven't moved on, for God's sake.
What's the statute of limitations on a rape? Is there one?
Oh, huh. Geez, I don't remember.
No?
I mean, yes, of course there's a statute. I could look it up, okay?
Could you find out? 'Cause what I'm thinking is that even if it went nowhere, even if she didn't win, it would still...
Ignoring her, Dan put his elbows on the table, his forehead to his palms.
When she finished, he raised his head.
You mean for later, Gwen? You're talking about all this for later on, right?
He glanced toward the door in a supreme effort to control himself. 'Cause I mean, I've got to focus on the case at hand right now in terms of John Curtis.
Dan paused, thinking how he should phrase it.
You realize I've spent months putting this case together. You know that, right? He saw Gwen opening her mouth to say something, but he pressed on over her.
Listen to me, Gwen. I went after him before, 4 years ago, when he was at his old firm. I never even told you, 'cause we got nowhere.
Gwen had stopped talking, was watching him impassively.
We got down the line, he was totally fucking guilty, and I couldn't do a thing about it.
When Gwen said nothing, Dan practically pleaded.
These guys, they're all so protected. Kerr's probably never done an honest day's work in his life. And what does he have? Billions. If I don't get Curtis this time around, I might as well stop going into work in the morning. I might as well... What'd you say?
I said, okay.
Oh, okay.
Dan sat back in the chair, holding his drink. Beside them, a young couple on a date were not getting any help with the wine list from the waiter.
Whatever you prefer, sir.
I could not say, sir. That would be up to you, sir. Dan smiled to himself, remembering those days of youth and cluelessness. Glad to be on the other side. Fuck fine wines.
How is she, by the way? He asked after a minute.
You seen her much? He put down the now empty glass and shook out his napkin.
How is Philippa?
After a pause, Gwen said, I've seen her here and there.
How's she doing?
With studied offhandedness, not looking at Gwen, but surveying the crowd that was slowly filling up the restaurant, Dan said,
She was pretty shaken up, right? Running into a guy who, you know.
He winced.
That must have sucked, huh?
As if Gwen had responded, Dan said,
Cool.
He was all a twitch and a quiver, Gwen noticed. He half rose and moved his chair a few inches. He carefully realigned the salt and pepper shaker, squinting at them.
She never said anything about him. About seeing him that night, did she?
To the waiter, he mouthed, Another, pointing at his glass. And to her, he said,
I don't want wine yet, do you?
Gwen's tone was fastidiously neutral.
What are you after, Dan?
He made a comic grimace.
Sorry. It's just, this case is beating me up.
The evidence is all there, he said more seriously.
But there's something weird about it.
He rotated his plate a quarter turn, studied it, then looked up at her as if to make an appeal.
The guy rapes her, and then he...
He stopped abruptly. You know what? Never mind. It's fine. I shouldn't be talking about it.
But...
Gwen cocked her head to the side.
The Steins? That has nothing to do with your case, does it?
She has nothing to do with your case. When Dan didn't reply at once, just looked highly uncomfortable, Gwen gave a short laugh and said,
I hardly think she's insider trading.
They always got the same things. The chicken marsala for Dan, the branzino for Gwen. Gwen would eye the ragu, but it was silly to order something like pasta that she could so easily make herself.
Dan?
She persisted when the waiter had brought Dan's second vodka tonic and left them alone again. There's absolutely no way, right? I mean, just to be clear.
What?
He said, distracted. Or pretending distraction. I don't think she knows what the stock market is. That look from him. That silent sizing up he was giving her. He fingered the glass but didn't drink. Not her. For a second, Gwen misunderstood him.
Phew, because you were freaking me out there.
But her husband was watching her unhappily. His face, why, it had pity in it.
Dan?
All at once, his meaning dawned on her. She heard the emphasis in those two little words.
No,
she gasped.
Not him. I don't believe it.
But Dan was nodding, inexorably nodding.
Afraid so.
Him and Curtis?
Gwen was aghast. How can that be?
Right?
Dan leaned across the table toward her.
It was killing me, killing me. I couldn't get my head around it. Skinker tipping him off, that scum of the earth, it was all backward.
Then it hit me, Gwen. Oh, my God, Curtis and the wife. The compromised wife. It's not your typical insider trading case at all. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's blackmail. Curtis is blackmailing him. He couldn't help but crow now.
We've known for a while.
Gwen looked stupefied.
Oh, my God.
She shook her head minutely back and forth.
Oh, my God. Of course he is.
The young man diagonally across from her shot a look of consternation in her direction. But Gwen couldn't seem to care about whether she was ruining his date. Her voice dropped to a whisper.
Of course he is.
Yep. Yeah.
Dan tried to catch her eye. He wanted to commiserate. He didn't care about Philippa, but he hated to see Gwen so shaken.
Nice, huh? Real lovely guy, Curtis, isn't he?
Does she know?
Dan let out a breath.
I don't think so. I'm guessing no.
Skinker's the kind of guy. He's probably kept the whole thing to himself, right? Trying to protect her. How would it benefit anyone for him to tell his wife? Why would he put that on her? She's already kind of fragile, right? Or was it all an act? Dan wondered. Even without the enabling Skinker wealth, he theorized, Mrs. Skinker would do just fine.
Right. Right.
Gwen said vaguely. He drank his vodka tonic and watched Gwen's face. Watched her go through a sped-up version of what he had gone through when he realized the Skinkers were involved. She gave a nod as if to herself.
Of course he is,
she murmured sadly. Waiting for their entrees, they talked of Mary. The results of the tests she'd taken for a gifted and talented spot in public kindergarten would arrive any day now.
She'll ace it,
Dan predicted, glad that Gwen seemed amenable to moving on to other topics. But when their food arrived, as he was hungrily eating, Gwen suddenly let her fork drop to her plate.
So, is there a way to shield her?
She burst out. Does she have to take the stand against him? It seems so unfair. She's the victim in all of this.
Well, I don't know if I'd call her a total victim.
What? You're kidding me. Why? Because of the prostitution? But she must have been desperate, Dan. Can you imagine how desperate? I don't think that's fair.
Dan switched his fork over to his right hand and speared a bite of chicken.
The what?
He said so quietly he might have been talking to himself. Gwen went on hotly. It's unbelievable, this guy's luck. He hires a prostitute for the night who conveniently becomes Mrs. Jedediah Skinker. He could not have planned it better if he'd tried, she added vehemently.
God, I hope you get him. I hope you kill him in court.
Dan laid down his fork and knife.
The prostitution?
Well, yes, right? I mean, that's the blackmail. That's what Curtis has got on Jed Skinker, isn't it? On her, I mean. Gwen made a convulsive gesture.
Oh, and don't tell me. On top of all that, he gilds the fucking lily with nursery school. Is that right? Did the Skinkers get them in?
Oh, my God.
The expression drained from Dan's face.
Oh, my God.
Excuse my French, said Gwen, who hardly ever swore. But
the modeling,
he intoned.
The hostessing.
His disgust with himself was total. His eyes looked as pained as when he had a terrible hangover.
She was a hooker,
he cried under his breath.
She was a fucking hooker.
He gripped his glass. He could have thrown it across the room.
I've got DiNapoli telling me those hostess girls sleep with her clients, and I'm saying, not her. It's not like that, Frank.
He couldn't believe it. He had fallen for it. The skinker mystique. He'd been had again. He could have cried at his sad, benighted state. He was so outraged and dismayed at his own idiocy that he barely noticed that across from him, Gwen had gone white. She was looking at him with horror.
Some kind of Mayflower Madam situation, was it?
And though Gwen didn't confirm this, he swore again and said,
Jesus Christ, I knew it, I knew it!
After a moment, he amended that to,
God damn it, I should have known it!
Her eyes were enormous. You didn't know.
What?
She repeated dully. You didn't know. He looked at her.
Oh, Jesus, Gwen.
He rushed to reassure her.
No, no, I would have found out.
His wife was going to cry. Her face was crumpling.
This has nothing to do with you. I would have found out today or tomorrow. I swear to God, I would have found out. It's amazing I got this far.
But, she faltered. What did you think had happened?
Oh, said Dan, waving a hand expansively. I figured he did something awful to her, but on some, I don't know, one-night stand. Thought she was cheating on her husband, and Skinker was trying to protect her even though he was the cuckold. Didn't want it to come out. Who would, right?
He put his hands to his temples.
How could I be so fucking idiotic? How?
At the funny strangled noise that came from his wife, Dan looked startled. I've ruined her life.
Ruined her life?
Dan spat out the words.
Are you kidding? This is the best thing that could have happened. This is huge. Curtis is going to jail. He's toast.
He tried to make her see the logic.
Doesn't she want him in jail for what he did to her?
He wondered aloud.
What did he do to her? I mean, how do you rape a prostitute?
Never mind.
An accusing edge to his voice, he said. Jesus, Gwen, you were talking prosecution a minute ago.
Gwen said hollowly, That was my idea.
But she doesn't want...
I have no idea what she wants.
Well, now, that's not true, Gwen thought bitterly. I know she wants the money. Does it have to come out, Dan?
Half-crazed, she seized on an unlikely salvation.
Can you forget I said anything? Just prosecute the case like you were going to before. Rewind the conversation. Make it as if I never said anything.
Later, in a reckoning she felt compelled to make, Gwen was grateful that at least he hadn't lied to her. At least he hadn't told her he would forget all about it.
I can't.
Dan drank his cocktail unhappily. He looked out at the restaurant, surveying the crowd. I can't say the guy was blackmailing Jed Skinker for inside information and not say why. It's totally relevant. It's been the missing piece all along. It's of utmost relevance to the case.
And it's going to be all over the post, he thought remorselessly, the minute we go to trial.
Curtis would never let himself go down alone.
People like that, he went on, you'd be surprised. Sometimes they feel better having it out in the open, like a kind of confession, you know? This may be freeing for her. You'll be surprised, I swear. She'll enter a new chapter of her life when it blows over.
Gwen looked at him out of her pale blue eyes.
Really?
He tried with more facts.
Skinker'll talk, now that we've got this. He's got nothing to hide. He'll talk and he'll implicate Curtis. He'll get off with very little, probably won't even do time. But John Curtis, that fucker's gonna go to jail.
Jed Skinker? Gwen repeated. She looked as if she didn't recognize the man Silvio had seated opposite her.
That man will never talk.
Yeah, Dan conceded, chasing some sauce around on his plate.
Maybe not. It almost doesn't matter at this point.
Skinker is being blackmailed by this slimeball while trying to protect his damaged wife. He'll come off looking like a hero. Gwen's silence would have panicked him if he hadn't been so elated by the news, now that his gross disappointment in himself was subsiding. He started shoveling in the remaining food, desperate for the meal to be over. He was itching for his blackberry, and only by concentrating fully on cutting and chewing the chicken could he manage not to grab it and start emailing colleagues.
Jesus H. Christ,
he said to himself as the fact presented itself again with all of its shocking ramifications.
Skinker's wife, a drunk and a whore. Who would have thunk it?
He went on eating and drinking. What else could he do if she wouldn't talk to him? Splashing wine diffidently into his glass and gulping it down. But that look in Gwen's eyes. The alcohol was hitting, and he feared. He feared for his soul. But I didn't do anything wrong, he wanted to plead. It's my job. I have to prosecute Curtis to the extent of my ability. So then why the hell did he feel so guilty? It was like that Saturday night last fall when he'd been passed out on the couch and Mary. Mary had come out of her room. Daddy, I had a nightmare. He could barely bestir himself to sit up. Shit-faced, and his kid needed him.
It's fine. Let's get you to bed.